Tears of joy as Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners are released. A ceasefire between Israel and Hamas and the U.S. response. A significant figure in the Catholic resistance to Nazism. Reflections from experts and the President of Ireland on one priest's life and legacy.
It was morally so striking that somebody was going to do all of that for those threatened.
We try to not just give food, not just give services, but our mission is to promote dignity, that the people will feel their own dignity that's God-given for each person.
A small plot of land having a big impact on the bodies and souls of those in need. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
Continue to pray for the world. Everyone hopes for a quick solution, even if, I mean, it would need a miracle, but a miracle can happen. That's our faith.
Hope for peace. As a pause in fighting between Israel and Hamas allowed hostages and prisoners to be reunited with their families. The truce between Israel and Hamas was extended several times over the week, but on Friday, Israel resumed airstrikes after Israeli leaders accused Hamas of violating the ceasefire. More than 100 hostages and 240 Palestinian prisoners have been released. Mark Irons brings us some of the emotional moments families are sharing as they reunite.
The conflict continues, but earlier this week, during a pause in fighting between Israel and Hamas, some scenes of hope. Hostages captured by Hamas released and reunited with loved ones. Thomas Hand was originally told his 9-year-old daughter Emily was killed during the October 7th Hamas terror attacks in southern Israel. He later found out she was a hostage. Now she's home.
All of a sudden the door opened up and she just ran. Push. Just like I imagined it, you know. Running together. I probably squeezed too hard.
This doctor in Israel has treated some of the hostage children now returned.
In general, I can say that they all came very skinny, very pale, lost maybe 10 to 15% of their weight.
In exchange for freed hostages, Israel has released Palestinian prisoners. This week, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Israel. He pushed for an extended ceasefire, but the fighting now continues. Image after image shows the destruction in Gaza and the impact on Palestinians. The Catholic Patriarch of Jerusalem, Pierre Battista Pizzaballa, hopes the release of hostages is a first step toward the end of the war. And last week in Rome, Pope Francis met with concerned Israelis and Palestinians who spoke about innocent lives lost in the Gaza Strip or captive family members who have yet to be returned to Israel. This woman had relatives killed in the Hamas attack. Others were captured and have been freed, but not all.
It has been an emotional roller coaster since October 7th. 10 days in, we learned that Carmela and Noya had been murdered. We had to find a way to keep fighting and not grieve. And now, 52 days in, Erez and Sahar have been returned to their mother. And yet, we're not whole yet because Ofer is still there.
According to Hamas officials, the youngest hostage, a 10-month-old baby boy, along with his 4-year-old brother and their mother, were killed in an Israeli airstrike. Israel has not confirmed that claim.
Everyone is affected. Everyone knows someone that is there. Everyone, or the Jews know soldiers that have been sent in Gaza. Palestinians, most of them have family over there, relatives or people that they've known.
Father David Grenier, a friar at the Franciscan Monastery of the Holy Land in America, based in Washington, D.C., works closely with fellow friars and communities in the Middle East, including holy sites in Bethlehem and Jerusalem, not far from the Gaza Strip. With the region reeling from war, life in the Holy Land isn't the same. In Bethlehem, in the West Bank of Israel, the typical annual Christmas festivities scheduled in the birthplace of Jesus have been canceled to mark solidarity with Palestinians suffering in Gaza.
No one is indifferent to what is going on right now. Pray for the world, pray for the peace, pray for the end of the war.
Mark Irons, EWTN News In Depth.
Andrew Doran, who previously served on the policy planning staff at the U.S. Department of State and is currently a senior research fellow at the Philos Project, joins us now to provide his expert insight into what's happening now in Israel. Andrew, thank you for joining us again. The Hamas-Israel war continues. Israel says Hamas violated the ceasefire, triggering Israeli airstrikes in the south. What do we know as of right now?
Well, we know that the humanitarian pause, as it's referred to in Israel officially and on the street, was broken by Hamas. And Hamas has failed to keep the terms of these humanitarian pauses repeatedly. And despite that, the international community continues to get leverage in Western institutions and Western media on Israel by suggesting that it's Israel breaking the terms of the humanitarian pauses. There are, at last count, I think 137 people being held, 10 of them over the age of 75, two of them children. And the majority now are males, but the but Hamas has failed to stick to the terms as it laid them out. And there have been some pretty traumatic, pretty awful scenes on social media just over the last couple of days, specifically with a with an Israeli family. And so this trauma that began for Israelis and the Jewish people around the world has extended now into December. And it really has taken a terrible psychological toll.
Now, before we talk about that pressure, the Western pressure that you mentioned, negotiations to resume the ceasefire and the continued exchange of prisoners and hostages are reportedly still occurring. What might that look like and for how long?
Well, the negotiations... Certainly, there is a segment of the Israeli population that is putting a lot of pressure. This is from the right mostly, but Israelis who are just being very practical about this, saying if we negotiate now, that gives Hamas more time and it increases the likelihood, not just that Israelis are going to be kidnapped in the Middle East and around the world, but that other Westerners are going to become the targets of kidnapping, because it's going to send a message that this is a successful negotiating mechanism. The longer the war goes on, the more pressure is likely to come down on Israel from Europe and from the United States, from the West, to stop the war. Perhaps ironically, the quietest but strongest support for Israel's operations against Hamas are coming from Sunni Arab governments in the Gulf and in North Africa, who are saying you have to finish Hamas, or this is going to be a problem we're all dealing with for a long time. So this is one of the paradoxes. Israel needs to finish this operation militarily, but this is something that's just simply built into the Israeli DNA. They will negotiate. They'll negotiate to get a dead body back. And so certainly they're going to negotiate.
The Pope's comments after he met with both Israeli and Palestinians calling the conflict terrorism were criticized by some who called his words ambiguous, while others took offense at the insinuation of the Israeli counterattack as terror. What should we consider in the Holy Father's words? Is he involved in these peacekeeping efforts? I know he wouldn't want them called that.
Well, I don't know who on the Pope's staff might be an expert in urban combat, for example. but if you look at the plans that we reportedly proposed to the Israelis for Mosul and Raqqa, which I saw firsthand in 2017, that included a very powerful barrage of airstrikes that was pretty indiscriminate. They do their best to work around that. I am a little bit surprised that the Israelis opted for the approach that they did, which was to put more IDF soldiers at risk and reduce the reliance on airstrikes. So far, they've been able to keep both civilian casualties comparatively low and IDF casualties low. The Israelis probably, when this is done, will have provided a blueprint for how to conduct urban combat in a high population density area where human shields are being availed by state actors and quasi-state actors and terrorist groups like Hamas. That's how a lot of people who are observing this more closely see it. And so the Pope's remarks suggesting that the IDF is in any way comparable to Hamas is deeply disconcerting. There are several hundred Palestinian Christians in Gaza. There are many thousands of Palestinian Christians in the West Bank, and there are millions around the region. And if the Vatican were to speak as candidly and as freely as it's able to about Israel and its criticisms, if it were to do the same about Hamas, Islamic Jihad, the Palestinian Authority, other Muslim-majority governments,
they might not be safe.
They would not, absolutely not be safe, and that's a well-known fact. But it's something that if you're not an expert, you haven't traveled the region, you don't know to read between the lines. And so criticism ends up being leveled against Israel in a way that suggests that there's moral parity. And that all things being equal, perhaps that wouldn't be a problem. But we're living at a time of unprecedented anti-Semitism here in the United States, and anti-Semitism that we've not seen in Europe since 1945, and anti-Semitism spreading around the world. And if Catholics think that it's going to stop there, they're mistaken. We really ought to know better. And the Catholic Church's hierarchy ought to either speak with moral clarity or perhaps be silent.
Andrew, Secretary Blinken warned this week that Israel has weeks, not months, to complete the objective of destroying Hamas. What kind of an impact does that pressure, that Western pressure you discussed, have?
Well, it's unfortunate that Secretary Blinken set a deadline, because this gives this means that time is now the ally of Hamas rather than Israel, rather than the IDF. And this is happening at a time that Israel's also under pressure to conduct these humanitarian pauses to get their hostages back. Unfortunately, this probably makes it less likely that Israel will be able to both get its hostages back and achieve its mission objectives militarily, which would leave Hamas essentially in place. So this is deeply troubling.
To the detriment of many others who fear the reign of Hamas. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Of course.
When we return, illness keeps the Pope from traveling to a world climate change meeting, but it didn't stop him from working from home. We'll be right back.
I think what's really missing is an understanding of Justice Thomas, the person, and an understanding of Justice Thomas, the jurisprudence.
An influential federal judge joins us to decipher the jurisprudence of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. We talk to Judge Amul Thapar about his new book. And a special plenary indulgence is offered during the Advent and Christmas season. We'll explain. EWTN News In Depth will be right back.
Per favore, non dimenticatevi di pregare per me. Buon pranzo e arrivederci.
Pope Francis asking for prayers and wishing everyone a good day last Sunday after a papal aide delivered the Angelus. The Holy Father spoke via video link instead of the window of the papal palace that overlooks St. Peter's Square due to the inflammation in his lungs. The Vatican says Francis was suffering from a mild flu. A CT scan showed lung inflammation, and the Holy Father was put on antibiotics. Vatican leaders say to ensure Francis's recovery, he would not attend the United Nations climate conference known as COP28. With rumored reluctant obedience to doctors' orders on the part of the Holy Father, the trip was canceled. His ongoing illness forced Francis to reschedule his Monday appointment with abuse victims to Tuesday. 21 victims from France visited the Pope at his residence after meeting earlier with the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors. Francis thanked the survivors for their courage and assured them that their voices are heard and the Church is committed to eradicating abuse. Also at the Vatican, Francis's right-hand man, Secretary of State Cardinal Pietro Parolin, sent a stern letter to bishops in Germany related to the German synodal path. In the October 23rd letter, Parolin made some key points. The ordination of women and changes in the Church's teaching on homosexuality will not be subjects of discussion at upcoming meetings this January. In the letter, Parolin also reminded bishops of potential disciplinary consequences for anyone defying church teaching. Parolin also reminded German bishops to stay on the path of the Universal Church, which is currently in the midst of its own synodal way, led by the Holy Father. A.C. Wimmer, the editor-in-chief of CNA Deutsch, the German-language arm of the Catholic news agency, joins us now to talk about the latest stories out of the Vatican. A.C., thank you for joining us. This German synodal path has pushed several controversial ideas. What are you hearing from church leaders in Germany in response to Perelin's letter?
Hi, Mons. It's great to be with you. We're hearing a lot, actually. Finally, some reactions coming both from the so-called progressive camp as from the so-called conservatives. In particular, Bishop Stefan Oster of Passau has come out saying, yes, unity is under threat among the German bishops, whilst those who are pushing for what has been resolved, they think, at the German synodal way, are, of course, saying that they need to continue with their reforms. And so you do have a picture of disunity forming and coming out, and there is an ongoing debate about this and how it might be damaging relationships, not only within Germany, but also with neighboring Poland, which is a crucial and sensitive relationship, and, of course, with the Church in Rome.
Yes, and so bishops in Germany, when you talk about that lack of cohesiveness, they have said that they want to set up their own synodal council to govern the Church in Germany, effectively negating the power of the Holy See. Are we anywhere near that being a reality?
Absolutely, and we're getting closer, Mons. So that is quite alarming for observers, I imagine, also from Rome, but certainly to those that we've spoken to for CNA and CNA Deutsch. They're saying if that permanent synodal council is really going to happen, then it will no longer be commensurate with the sacramental structure of the Church. That is how the Vatican put it to the German bishops, who still seem to be bent on doing this, though.
Well, that's something we'll be watching for January. But in other Vatican news, after a week of rumors, multiple sources have reported that Pope Francis will be removing Cardinal Raymond Burke's Vatican apartment and salary. The Cardinal has been a frequent critic of Pope Francis's policies. Has there been any confirmation of the reasons for what appears to be punishment?
Well, we've had papal biographer Austin Ivory saying that he had spoken to the Holy Father about this and that, yes, it was because... So we hear, this is purported, of course, the Pope designated Cardinal Burke as someone who was threatening church unity. And there you have unity again, Monte. So this is very pertinent also with a view to the situation in Germany, but also with the question of how the Vatican is communicating to bishops, to cardinals, and what kind of steps they're taking. It is creating a lot of, shall we say, interest also among German-speaking prelates across Europe. And even across the world, I've spoken to people in Australia saying, what is happening to Cardinal Burke? Why isn't it happening to the Germans?
Now, for some context, Christoph, Cardinal Burke's appointments are still there. He still votes in a conclave. He still has all of the authority that comes with that, just not these other privileges. Canon law does provide for disciplinary measures. But isn't it unusual to see this kind of a response that threatens the livelihood of a cardinal? Is this confirmed in any way that it'll actually happen?
Well, apparently it's confirmed by going by what Austin Ivory, the papal biographer, has said, not by what the official spokesman of the Vatican, Matteo Bruni, has said, Monse. So I think we can presume it will happen. But of course, you're pointing to a very important question. What happens to a person if you take away their abode or their pay is one thing. The canonical question in particular for also the Germans is if they were to ordain women, as they've now more or less resolved at the German synodal way, they might actually be facing excommunication, a far more serious. And as you've pointed out, the consequence for Cardinal Burke may be that his livelihood may be in question, but his status as a cardinal remains absolutely resolved. He is, of course, a Catholic, a prelate, a cardinal of the Catholic Church.
Yes, someone who is coming in as a modern apostle. We will be looking to you for more on Cardinal Burke, of course, but on another notable move from the Vatican this week, Pope Francis added 11 new members to the Dicastery for the Laity, Family, and Life, including two married couples. What does this mean for the Vatican office?
Look, I think it's a very smart move to include people who are affected, who are living the vocation of being married, and it is the sort of witness that the Vatican has called for, that Pope Francis has called for, that the synodal processes have called for. The Synod on Synodality has spoken about this and has included, as we've reported, lay people to their processes as delegates, as voting members. So this might be a move that is commensurate with the overall moves that we've seen under the Francis Pontificate of making sure that the people who are part and parcel of what the Church is doing here and are able to contribute to it in a meaningful way right there in Rome.
Well, we look forward to seeing what that means, too. Thank you so much, Christoph.
Thank you kindly.
The Week in Review is next, including proof of life for an imprisoned Catholic bishop in Nicaragua. For the first time in months, pictures and video are released from the dictatorship.
To work in a beautiful space, to work with my hands and produce a tangible, a tangible example of caring for the earth and, you know, our interaction with the earth, and for it to go to people in need, I feel very fortunate.
The tangible and intangible gifts of their work. Still to come, the many hands pitching in to help a unique ministry grow. Topping the Week in Review, somber news on Friday from the United States Supreme Court. The first woman to serve on the High Court has died. Retired Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was 93. An appointee of President Ronald Reagan, O'Connor served for nearly 25 years, making her one of the most powerful women of her era. Nominated as a conservative, but later known for her independence on the bench, she played a pivotal role in numerous closely contested cases involving abortion, religion, affirmative action, and sex discrimination. She rejected the idea of eliminating abortion and co-wrote the opinion in Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992, which set new standards for judging abortion cases, but reaffirmed the core of Roe versus Wade. When she retired in 2006 to care for her husband, who had dementia, she was succeeded by Justice Samuel Alito. You can read more on O'Connor's judicial legacy in our sister publication, The National Catholic Register. New insights today into Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas's judicial impact from Judge Amul Thapar of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. In 2017, Thapar became President Donald Trump's first Court of Appeals appointment. He has long been a student of the legal philosophy of originalism, for which Thomas is famous. His position as the first Indian-American federal judge also gives him unique insights into Justice Thomas, which he shares in his newly released book, The People's Justice, Clarence Thomas, and the Constitutional Stories That Define Him. I recently sat down with him here in our D.C. studios. Here is Judge Amul Thapar on the record. You wrote a book with stories that tell the impact of Justice Thomas's decisions and his cases, or where he was lead in these cases, through the eyes of the person it affected. Tell me a little bit about why you wrote that.
The real stories of the people that come in front of the court, the real stories of the cases are rarely told. And so what I thought is the way to explain originalism, the way to explain Justice Thomas's jurisprudence, is through the eyes of the litigants, the real people whose lives are impacted by these cases. And when you read the stories of their life and how they end up in the Supreme Court and how Justice Thomas's jurisprudence impacts them, you see something much different. You see that Justice Thomas is first and foremost an originalist, but he cares passionately about people.
Well, you just used what I would call a legal dirty word, which is a word that a lot of Americans wouldn't understand, originalism. Originalism, this legal theory, this application of the law that many legal outlets, but also mainstream journalists are quoting as something that Americans should be fearful of. Explain originalism for the everyday American.
You've got to understand what the American people approved. Think about me, the son of Indian immigrants. My dad came here with a one-way ticket and a $5 bill because he was one of five children raised by a single mom in India back in the 40s and 50s. His dad passed away when he was two, and they literally didn't have running water, didn't have a bathroom, and his mom gave him a ticket and a $5 bill. He was the youngest. She saved up for him and gave it to him and said, go make something of yourself. And he flew to America. And only in this country, right, with the will and the grace of the American people, can someone like me sit on one of the highest courts in this country. And so I've got to trust the American people. That's at its core what originalism is about. Do you trust unelected judges or do you trust the American people? People say, well, the Constitution's so hard to amend, so originalists make a stay in time. No. Where do you think the Civil Rights Act comes from? That's not the Constitution. We can pass laws. Of course, you can amend the Constitution. It's been amended multiple times since the Bill of Rights. But you can also pass laws federally, pass laws at the state level, pass things at the local level, and then the American people have more say. They're more vested in the democracy. Justice Thomas came from the segregated South and rose to the highest court in the land. I rose to one of the second highest courts. The opportunity in this country is great, but for people like us that are here by the grace of the American people, we put our faith in the American people and not unelected judges. And that's what originalism is about at its core.
You have a challenge to your readers when they open your book. Would you want to live in Justice Thomas's America? Is that what you meant by that challenge?
When you read those cases and you see what Justice, just every ruling of Justice Thomas in the book, imagine it's the majority. Imagine in every case, you're going to, and think of that America. That's an originalist America, because as everyone says, he's the purest originalist on the court. That's an originalist America. Would you want to live in it? I challenge his critics. As I say at the end of the introduction, of the flap, even his critics might be surprised if they were giving it an honest read.
You talk about the legacy of Justice Thomas as representing black people. Is that something that's also important for you?
It is in this sense. You know, people die to come to this country. Why? Because it's the land of opportunity. When a kid like me can get to where I'm at, that means something not only to Indians, to all sorts of immigrants' kids, that you can accomplish anything if you put your mind to it. I think about where my dad came from, and he used to tell us when we complained, he said, this is the greatest country in the world. Roll your sleeves up and get to work, and you can accomplish anything. Justice Thomas's grandfather said to him, when he said, I can't do something, old man Kent is dead. You know how I know? I helped bury him. The same message, the message that anything's possible in this country. And I'm an example of that. Clarence Thomas is an example of that.
And it's because you take the law seriously. You once jailed an 84-year-old nun for breaking into a uranium plant, is that correct?
That's
and defacing
correct.
It?
Yes.
And she was there for how long? How long was she in jail? 35 months?
Yes.
Okay. Why?
Breaking the law has consequences, and trust me, I prayed a lot about that, but not as much as I prayed about some of the harder sentencings I've had. You know, the sentencing is really hard, but you can't make exceptions. Like, that's not our job. Again, if the American people say this is the right sentence, and I believe the law covers the conduct, then that's what you got to do. A jury convicted her. It was my obligation to sentence her. And it was my, she asked, ironically, for life.
You said she wasn't remorseful.
Well, she thought it was, to be fair, I mean, she was an objector to nuclear power, right? And so if she thought she was doing the right thing, she was an amazing woman, right? But she made a mistake. That mistake, or she committed a crime. And that crime has consequences. How can we create exceptions for one group of people because they put the religious cloth on? That can't be the exception. There can't be exceptions. Think about what went on in our church. I mean, if you start creating exceptions, where does it stop? The law has to be followed. I took an oath to uphold the law. That oath was important to me.
Let's talk about Second Amendment rights. This is one of the stories that you tell in this book. You talk about Second Amendment rights, and you tell a specific story about a case with the grandson of a slave who was in Chicago, wanted to have the American dream, worked his tail off to make that happen.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then the crime rate soared, and all of a sudden he's in a precarious situation where he wants to protect his family, and he can't. Because in Chicago, he could not own a gun. What happened in that case, and why did you tell that story?
Otis McDonald moved up from the South to pursue a better life. He was a sharecropper's son, grandson of slaves, came to Chicago and enlisted in the Army, served our country honorably, got out. The GI Bill provided him an opportunity to get an education. He pursued that education at night while he worked by day. All he wanted to do was to provide a better opportunity for his wife and kids than was given to him, not through anyone's fault, he recognized, but just through circumstances. He worked his tail off, as you mentioned, and bought a house in Morgan Park. It was perfect when he moved in. But at the same time, the crime was moving out in his community on the south side of Chicago. And this perfect middle-class integrated neighborhood was suffering from gang violence and drug crimes and people breaking in. And he, as the book recounts, six kind of harrowing crimes him and his family suffer. And he did different things to try and stop the crime. First, he put bars on his house. When that didn't work, he put in an alarm system. He joined a community group. He became the head of the community group. But what broke the camel's back is these kids and wife are sleeping in the houses as he, and luckily the neighbor saw someone that had broken in and was hiding under his car and called the police. And Otis knew that had that eagle-eyed neighbor not seen that happen, it might be too late. By the time someone calls the police, they might be inside. And you know what was unique? What he saw in the chapter recounts it is that the criminals weren't obeying the gun laws. They had guns. The gang members had guns. He had guns pointed at him. Otis was just a hardworking janitor, head of the union, because of his education, became really successful from where he came, and yet he couldn't protect his family. He had had enough. He wasn't going to wait for someone to break in and do something harmful for his family where he didn't have recourse. And so he challenged the ruling that he could not possess a gun in the city of Chicago. And that case goes all the way to the Supreme Court. The punchline, right, is he wins. Justice Thomas writes a concurrence. The descendant of slaves writes a concurrence about when the 14th Amendment was passed in the Privileges or Immunities Clause. He points out back to the history that one of the reasons Frederick Douglass said, and he quotes it, he said, "We will never have equality without our gun rights." Why? Because what happened in the South is they were dispossessing blacks of guns through black codes. That's why the Privileges or Immunities Clause, one of the main reasons it was passed, that chapter recounts it, because it's just recounting what Justice Thomas said.
Just as a last question, what is your favorite part about being a judge? You mentioned you now, right now, have the best job. And you wouldn't necessarily want any other job. What is the best part of this job?
You know, it's my colleagues. I wish America, in a lot of ways today, resembled the courts in that we can disagree without being disagreeable. I'm very good friends with judges that see things differently than me. And we understand that. We try our best. We all try our best to get it right.
There was much more of my conversation with Judge Thapar, including why he converted from Hinduism to Catholicism. You can see the complete interview on the EWTN YouTube page. In other news this week, 3 days of public events celebrated the life of former First Lady Rosalynn Carter. The global humanitarian, helpmate to a president, and family matriarch died at the age of 96. At a memorial service in Atlanta, 99-year-old Jimmy Carter, who has been in hospice care for 10 months, was joined by President and Mrs. Biden and all the other surviving First Ladies in paying tribute to Mrs. Carter. A woman of deep faith, she was remembered as the glue that held the family together, a modern First Lady who sat in on cabinet meetings and professionalized the East Wing office of the First Lady. She was actively involved in fighting for the Equal Rights Amendment, which Mother Angelica herself had said just years before would have deeper effects on society than was visible at the present time. Carter's signature issue, however, was advocating for improving mental health services and recognition of the role of caregivers. A giant in the world of American foreign affairs has died. Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger passed away on Wednesday at the age of 100. A powerful force in both the Nixon and Ford administrations, Kissinger was the only person to ever serve as both Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. His pivotal role in the Vietnam War prolonged the fighting and expanded it into Laos and Cambodia.
One of his greatest achievements came in the 1970s, when his efforts led to the opening of diplomatic ties between the U.S. and China. As recently as this year, at age 100, he was greeted in China with a red carpet welcome. But Kissinger has long been a polarizing figure. Admirers have praised his diplomatic achievements, but critics say his foreign policy legacy has led to political instability and wars across the globe. The Nicaraguan dictatorship of Daniel Ortega released new photos and video of imprisoned Bishop Rolando Alvarez this week. It comes in response to demands from multiple organizations and even congressmen in the United States for proof of life. Alvarez, who is the bishop of Matagalpa, has been in prison since February, sentenced to 26 years behind bars for alleged treason. The Nicaraguan Ministry of the Interior says the video and photos show the conditions of Bishop Alvarez's confinement are preferential. Alvarez is one of hundreds of political prisoners Nicaragua's President Ortega has accused of conspiring against the government. Last February, the U.S. negotiated the release of more than 200 political prisoners from the regime, including priests, to be flown to the U.S. Bishop Alvarez refused the offer. That's a little bit of sunshine. It's a little bit of rain. A distinct American sound embraced by Dominican friars who weave scripture into their songs. Their music still to come. But first, the priest who defied the Nazis to save thousands of lives will be right back.
I think I feel first and foremost as an Irish person an enormous sense of pride, but also I think his legacy is one that challenges us all.
A sense of pride for the courageous work of a humble priest who defied the terror and horror of the Nazis. Monsignor O'Flattery became a leading voice in providing safe hiding places for those escaping the Nazis during the Second World War. But as EWTN's Vatican correspondent Colm Flynn shows us, he was not the only Irishman who provided refuge for those targeted by Hitler's army.
In September 1943, during World War II, the Nazis took control of Rome. It was an incredibly tense and dangerous time, especially for the 12,000 Jews living in the city. Hitler wanted to include them in his final solution, and in just a few days, more than 1,000 Jews were rounded up in the city and sent to Auschwitz. Thousands more prisoners of war were also on the run. It was at this time that an Irish priest, Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty, was working at the Vatican and decided he wanted to help. In secret, he started to hide thousands of Jews and prisoners of war from the Nazis in different homes, religious houses around Rome, and inside the Vatican itself. The Nazis knew exactly what he was doing, but couldn't touch him as long as he remained within the perimeter of Vatican City, an independent and neutral state. And it was during these crucial months Monsignor O'Flaherty was living inside Campo Santo within Vatican City.
German soldiers outside, inside the Vatican State, the Vatican guards, of course, the Swiss guard. And so it was here surrounded by police and military.
So a heightened tension must have been in the air with the guards.
On the one hand side, yes. On the other hand side, it was very secure here. Under Pius XII, the Vatican was absolutely neutral. So the Germans had not the courage to come in and risk a major conflict.
It was from this very place we're standing that Monsignor O'Flaherty is credited with saving the lives of over 6,500 people by using his vast network of contacts to offer hiding places throughout Rome and beyond.
And you see, this is the last corner of the whole compound, so nobody could see him or know when he's coming, going. He had one of those, in those times, three rooms, only three, and one of the three he had.
Monsignor O'Flaherty would risk his own life by sneaking out of the Vatican at night and therefore leaving the neutral territory. He would meet fleeing Jews and bring them back to the Vatican, even dressing some of them as priests and nuns to get them past the German soldiers and Swiss Guard.
The name was simply Organization. They had many friends, helpers, and a team, a whole team which organized about 200 safe rooms, safe houses in the city.
It's important to point out that although Monsignor O'Flaherty is well known because of how many people he saved, he wasn't the only one helping the Jewish community during this horrific time. There were other Irish religious in Rome who did the exact same thing, but are rarely talked about. For example, at the Church of San Clemente in Rome are the Irish Dominicans.
Well, here we are in the 12th century Basilica of San Clemente, one of the most extraordinary buildings in the world. The Irish Dominicans, we've been here since 1677. Of course, refugees from Ireland, you know, from the persecution, Cromwellian persecution in Ireland. And it's amazing to think then that during the Second World War, we were able to give hospitality to refugees.
Father Paul Lawler is the prior here at the monastery and is bringing me to the very top floor.
And this was added in 1400. The building itself is 12th century. Such an old structure, you know, that we're still living in buildings that were built in the 12th century.
Wow, isn't that amazing? Still standing strong.
Still living. Well, this is the corridor where students lived coming out from Ireland, and indeed still live here. But during the war, there were no students coming out, and this corridor was empty. The Jews were being rounded up, and as we know now, being brought to extermination camps. Pope Pius XII asked religious houses and institutions to take them in.
The Irish Dominicans were just one of many religious groups who answered the call.
San Clemente brought in five that lived in this corridor. So they lived here during the day and went down to the garden at night time. Some of them went to Israel afterwards and wrote back to thank and say, you know, they would never forget the hospitality of the Irish Dominicans. Really something we can take pride in, you know, that we could reach out and to these people who are in such danger.
It is a source of pride for the Irish community in Rome, but also back in Ireland and in County Kerry, where Monsignor O'Flaherty grew up and went to school. This is the school he went to, the Presentation Monastery Primary School. This is the old building, but the school has since moved across the road to a new home. And inside, the memory of their past pupil lives on, where the students learn about his story. And one pupil even has a special connection to him, the grandson of one of Monsignor O'Flaherty's good friends, who even gifted him a special cross.
This is a cross that Hugh O'Flaherty, my granddad Jimmy Toomey, was like a great friend of his, and Hugh O'Flaherty gave a couple of crosses to most of his, to a few of his friends, and my granddad got one. My uncle would tell me, like, he'd tell me, like, what he was like, and he was a very shy person. But he'd never talk about, like, what he did in World War II. He'd just be very shy, kind of, about it.
What have you learned from his story?
I learned, like, just be nice to everyone. It doesn't matter, like, who they are, or their different religion or anything.
Outside Rome, wrecked tanks are not seen dead as the Yanks move in. Rome itself is almost without a scar, but where the German resists, he is slaughtered.
When Rome was liberated by US forces in June of 1944, there were celebrations in the streets. Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty had survived and helped thousands of others to survive as well. A recent visit by the Irish President Michael D. Higgins to the Vatican to meet Pope Francis saw him stop by the plaque of Monsignor O'Flaherty at Campo Santo, where he laid a wreath and spoke of his bravery.
President Higgins, when you think of the life and legacy of Monsignor O'Flaherty, what strikes you?
What strikes me very much is, I think, how clever he was, because certainly the atmosphere of the time meant that he took considerable risks, even with those who were very close to him. So, and as I said, it was morally so striking that somebody was going to do all of that for those threatened.
And on that plaque paying tribute to Monsignor O'Flaherty, it states he died in 1963 and is buried not here among the Vatican powerful, but instead he's buried back in Carrigsaveen in Ireland. For this is where his sister lived, who cared for him in his final years, and where his niece Pearl still lives today.
What do you think when you think of him and what he did, his legacy?
I think he was a mighty man, and he was a fantastic uncle. He had fierce interest in everything we ever did.
What was he like as a person?
Strict.
Strict?
He was, do you notice, he had such a big heart, he always had the interest of the person there at the moment, no matter what the crisis was. He dealt with it, and he tried to make the thing easier.
Are you proud?
I am, I'm very proud. You know, all you can say is he did his best.
Hugh O'Flaherty was only 65 when he died, but his legacy truly lives on today.
As a person, I think his legacy challenges us all to think on an individual level. How do we respond to those in need of refuge and sanctuary?
He had no fear. He was special. I mean, for him, everything was possible.
I think the lesson is that, like, you should always think about other people and not just be... It's okay to be scared, but you should always try to help other people when you can.
60 years after his death, the incredible memory and legacy of Hugh O'Flaherty lives on. And not just at home in County Kerry, but as you've seen, also here at the Vatican in Rome, where we remember the remarkable courage and kindness that he showed to so many people at a time of such suffering and pain.
In Rome, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
A longer version of Colm's coverage of Monsignor O'Flaherty can be viewed on the EWTN YouTube page listed on your screen. We invite you to follow all of our social media channels to see more from EWTN News in Depth.
You get to walk by and instill a little hope into somebody or encourage them, even pray with them if they're in need of prayer.
Planting seeds of hope in the lives of the less fortunate. After the break, we visit a farming ministry sustained by clergy and laity. From farm to fork, Catholic religious and laity are tilling the soil, harvesting the fruits of their labors, and serving up delicious hot meals. EWTN News In-Depth's Roselle Regis visited a ministry where volunteers roll up their sleeves in the country and in the city to help serve others.
We are a ministry of the Franciscan Friars Conventual. Our mission is mainly twofold, to care for our earth and to care for the poor.
On 310 acres of rolling hills and woodlands in Ellicott City, Maryland, on the property of the Shrine of St. Anthony, you can find Little Portion Farm.
Well, we grow probably over 30 different types of vegetables, over a dozen different kinds of fruits, a lot of herbs.
But the land hasn't always been that fruitful.
And for a long time, the friars leased out the property to other farmers who used kind of conventional industrial style of agriculture. Pesticide use, herbicide use.
Until Laudato Si came out, Pope Francis's encyclical, which focused renewed attention on the long-standing Catholic teaching to care for creation.
Along with the rest of the world and around the time that Laudato Si came out in 2015, they started thinking about how we could use the land better.
For the friars, hearing the cry for the earth and the cry for the poor meant building a sustainable farm that feeds those in need.
I sense that St. Francis provided a kind of a great way of recognizing creation as a brother or sister and the ability to see God's action and work in creation. So I think that the environment is obviously something that we have an impact upon as human beings, and our choices matter.
The friars, alongside farm manager Matt Jones, started putting in the work to restore the depleted soil. And after some time, they planted their first seed.
2019 was the first year we consider kind of the beginning of Little Portion Farm, which is the first year that we planted vegetables. So we started very small. We started with only 10 beds.
Since then, Little Portion Farm has grown, harvested, and donated over 60,000 pounds of produce.
The food that we produce is wonderful and nutritious, but the work is even more beneficial.
Kelly Neal is the volunteer coordinator at the farm. Since the farm does not use any machinery, Neal says the volunteers are the core of the ministry. Some volunteers have been with Little Portion Farm since the beginning.
Just seeing the expansion and the different kinds of foods that we have, like, that's one of the things that I really love about it. It's a bit of a dignity that you give to people to say you're important enough to try Jerusalem artichokes or, you know, okra or some strange squash flower.
We're steward of what we grow and get it out to the community. It's just so important, you know, for our faith, you know, to pay it forward.
Most of the produce harvested here at Little Portion Farm is donated to the Franciscan Center of Baltimore. During peak season, the farm donates about 500 pounds of food a week.
We get to have these gourmet-looking, the best-looking produce coming from this farm, and it's all directed towards our guests, our neighbors.
Jeff Griffin is the director of the Franciscan Center of Baltimore, which serves as many as 1,000 meals a day to those in need.
The hot meal program, we serve probably 400 to 600 people a day at our center, and then we also serve another 150 to 200 meals every day, 7 days a week, to homeless encampments.
In addition to the hot meal program, the center is also in the process of starting a client choice pantry, which will provide organic produce to people who might have trouble buying fresh fruits and vegetables. Griffin says with the price of produce skyrocketing, they are seeing more and more clients.
Every single day, we're serving our community.
Chef Derek Purcell serves as the culinary director at the center. He tells us that one of his greatest joys is working with Little Portion Farm to create an in-season menu.
Since we're preparing food from scratch, we got to talk with Matt, and we know exactly what's coming out of the field, and we implement that within a day or two after it hits our property.
Sister Ann Hefner loves volunteering at the center and helping clients with their spiritual needs.
Bring them to God in a way that you're standing with them. You're not pointing the way. You're not, you know, above. You are with them, holding their hands. And I think that's what we do here.
Rosal Rages, EWTN News in Depth.
Staying on a little bit of a country theme, from farming in the country to country and bluegrass music, you may be conjuring images of straw hats, flannel, and banjos. Well, how about friars? The Hillbilly Thomas are a team of Dominicans who met while studying in their formation house in Washington, D.C. They recently played at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas Aquinas in Rome. We give you a sampling of their music in our Images of the Week.
Life's a little bit of sunshine.
Hillbilly Thomas began in 2017 and have several CDs. You can visit their website, hillbillythomas.com, to find out more about them and when they may be playing at a parish near you. And if you have a Franciscan parish near you, all the better this Advent and Christmas season. The Vatican has approved the special plenary indulgence if you pray in front of a nativity at a Franciscan church. It's in honor of St. Francis, who is credited with creating the nativity scene 800 years ago in 1223. The indulgence will be offered from the Solemnity of the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin on December 8th to the Feast of the Presentation on February 2nd. Conditions to receive a plenary indulgence is detachment from all sin, sacramental confession, Holy Communion, and prayer for the intentions of the Pope. Thanks for joining us this week. We hope you enjoyed our program. Tune in next week for more news important to your Catholic life. See you then.